I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. U.S. health officials say more flu vaccine is on the way, and no doubt more fighting words about the flu from the presidential candidates are as well. The flu vaccine shortage and the fear it has created have both led Americans over the border to get their vaccines in Canada. Canadian pharmacy owner Larry Preddy is advertising flu shots in newspapers in North Dakota.
I sense a little bit of panic on south of the border in some cases, and this may create a lot of awareness to people of the importance of getting a flu shot.
On the stump yesterday, the presidential candidates traded barbs. John Kerry said the administration was incompetent and released this ad.
Seniors and children wait. Not enough vaccines for pregnant women. A George Bush mess. It's time for a new direction.
While in St. Petersburg, Florida, President Bush insisted his administration is on the case.
I know there are some here who are worried about the flu season. I want to assure them that our government is doing everything possible to help older Americans and children get their shots.
Well, joining us on the line is Associated Press science writer Deetra Henderson. And Deetra, let's do the math first. Yesterday, Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson said that another 2.6 million additional doses of flu vaccine will be available in January. And those shots, along with other medications, will meet most of the demand this flu season. Well, how does that figure when 48 million vaccines were lost when the factory in Britain, you know, was shut down earlier this month?
Well, I think what's key here is that there's an attempt to vaccinate the highest risk individuals first. So if you take those additional 2.6 million doses that Aventis is making, that makes the Aventis contribution 58 million. There are 2 million doses of flu mist, that's 60 million. And then there's a 40 million dose supply of antivirals. What those drugs do is they reduce the course of illness. So if you get the flu, you're sick for less time. If you don't have the flu, they can prevent illness. Altogether, it's about 100 million individuals. Now, we know that the group of high-risk individuals who should be getting flu shots are in the 100 million range, but you know, historically, half of those people, even though they should get shots, don't get shots. So if those vaccination patterns hold, yes, there should be enough flu doses around for the people who need it most.
Of course, with the fear that's been brought up now, maybe more people will want to get the shots, which could cause a problem. But Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, was on the CBS Early Show today. He said the shots would be there in time to help. Is that true? Is January in time?
It really depends on what happens this flu season. Now, if you look at the last 21 flu seasons, four or five peaked in December, five peaked in January, nine peaked in February, and three peaked in March. It's a 21-22-year history. So depending on what happens this year, those flu vaccine doses could arrive just in time or a little too late.
And we should remind people, it takes about 2 weeks for the flu vaccines to kick in.
It does.
Right. We're reading reports of clinics in Canada selling vaccines to Americans, one, 100 a day, and it's by a lottery. What's your sense of that crossing the border issue?
In some provinces, like Ontario, they are asking for ID so that the people getting flu shots are truly Canadian. There are other provinces trying to cut down on the Americans coming across the border. And so I don't really see in the reports coming out of Canada any uniformity in how this is being handled.
Well, what does Health Secretary Thompson have to say about Americans being able to go to Canada for flu shots, but not being able to get, for instance, cheaper prescription drugs from there?
Well, the question wasn't raised in precisely that way. What Secretary Thompson was asked is whether this was an inconsistency with the administration trying to curb Canadian prescription sales to American consumers, using the safety issue as the wedge. He was asked, well, how can the administration now look to Canada to supply flu vaccine? And he and Lester Crawford, the acting commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, see this as a completely different issue. These flu vaccine doses are going to be handled on a government-to-government purchase. The FDA is currently in negotiations with the company. They're talking to Health Canada about their regulatory process, and they will have a chance to review all of the regulatory materials and the safety checks and the testing of these flu vaccine doses. And the FDA, in addition, will send its own inspectors to this plant to do their own work with their own eyes.
So he spoke about the U.S. government buying vaccines as opposed to individuals.
Yes, and it really gets down to the safety question. because the FDA is involved on this and the U.S. government is involved, they will have their safety questions answered before those drugs change hands.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, we'll ask a doctor about the individual decisions to purchase vaccines from Canada. Dietra, thank you.
Thank you.
Dietra Henderson, science writer for the Associated Press. And we do turn now to an expert on infectious diseases, Dr. William Schaffner. He's chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville. And Dr. Schaffner, Canadians get their vaccines for free under their health plan. But what do you think about Americans crossing the border to buy vaccines from Canada?
Well, it makes me smile. It's American initiative and perhaps some Canadian initiative also.
Is it safe?
Oh, I'm sure that's safe vaccine. It's been licensed for use in Canada. But the process is underway where the FDA is now looking at that and will give it its good housekeeping seal of approval.
Right, but that begs the question, why does Canada have a surplus? And what happened here?
Well, as you know, influenza vaccine is a low-profit line, and so the number of manufacturers that we've had in the United States has diminished over time. We now have two major and one smaller manufacturer of influenza vaccine in the U.S., and one of them had a huge glitch, and so half the vaccine didn't get here.
So it's sort of the luck of the draw. Well, we read in USA Today that hospitals, grocery stores, doctors who negotiated with that right vaccine company, the one whose plant didn't get shut down, they'll get their vaccines. Businesses that negotiated with Chiron won't, and just sort of tough luck.
Well, it is tough luck, and we're in that position ourselves. But Aventis, that's the company that still has vaccine, is negotiating with the CDC to try to channel the remainder of its product that will go to institutions that have a high concentration of these patients that are in the high-risk categories. Mm-hmm. This will do two things. It'll get vaccine to the right folks and keep vaccine out of the more nebulous distribution market, which is where all those price hikes are happening.
But as you well know, this has become a part of the presidential campaign. The Democrats saying, is this any way to run a health care system? Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy said yesterday the president was engaged in an effort to put a happy face on a disaster. It sounds as if you don't think it's a disaster, but is it sort of egg on someone's face?
Oh, I think it's egg on all of our face. I'd like to stay away from that political formulation, and I hope that whatever administration deals with this much more seriously starting next year. We have to create an environment so that more manufacturers produce influenza vaccine, clearly.
Well, I wanted to ask you to go into that arena for just one second, though, if you could, because, you know, we're hearing, while Ted Kennedy has one accusation, on the other hand, I've heard at least one conservative talk radio commentator say that it's the Democrats who wouldn't allow a climate where companies could produce vaccines in this country. I think Tommy Thompson was also quoted as saying that John Kerry was one of those who didn't do anything to fix this problem in 20 years in service. So is that partly true, too?
I'm not here finger-pointing, but what's clearly true is that we have to be prepared as a society to pay more money for vaccines. And whether private medical care schemes or Medicaid and Medicare, they've been working very hard to keep the price of influenza vaccine down. That makes the profit margin very small. We have to be ready to pay some more money for the excellent protection that vaccines give us.
Right. And as you said, there is egg on several faces. The New York Times today is saying that the FDA knew about the history of problems at the Chiron factory in Britain and were asleep at the switch.
Well, that's a kind of a murky circumstance, and one wonders why people didn't know more. That does bother me.
Right. What would you like to see the FDA do now?
Oh, I'd like the FDA to allow in some Canadian vaccine, for starters, and then work more creatively with companies to make sure that there aren't any regulatory barriers that would come up next year and the year after.
And are you convinced, you're saying that at Vanderbilt Medical Center, you're running up against some shortages yourself. Are you convinced that you're going to be able to address the needs of your patients?
Well, we're resigned to the fact that we will not be able to meet our patients' needs optimally. We expect to get some of the nasal spray vaccine on site very shortly, and then we hope that we will be able to receive some of this other injectable vaccine that's coming on down the pike. Mm-hmm. Now, whether people in January will be interested in being vaccinated is another matter.
Yeah. So what do you think about Tommy Thompson's comments that, you know, everything's going to be taken care of?
Well, I think he was clearly trying to put the best face on a circumstance, both from his role as the kind of the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, but also in his political role.
Yeah. Well, given that, I wonder what your response is to reports in today's Washington Post that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, we know he's a doctor, he's been sending letters to members urging them to get flu shots because they shake so many hands. So it's important for them, you know, senators and representatives, to get their shots. That's a priority because they shake many hands. And lawmakers are apparently getting their shots quickly and for free.
Well, I'm smiling at that. I don't know whether politicians fall within the high priority group as articulated by the CDC.
Yeah. And with that in mind, what are you seeing? What are you confronting? I mean, what kinds of patients might not get shots that you have?
Well, we obviously in a major medical center care for many patients who are in those high-risk groups, people over age 65, people who are younger, who have diabetes, who are immunocompromised, and the like. And so we're working as hard as possible to get vaccine to those folks. And absent that, we're asking them to wash their hands, observe cough etiquette, to stay away from sick folks. If you're over 65, for example, perhaps get the pneumonia vaccine, the pneumococcal vaccine that might help prevent some of the complications of influenza.
And by the way, doctor, if we might take advantage of your expertise right now, we've heard that people who've had the shot in the past are more in danger. In other words, they should be sure that they get the shot now. Is that a myth?
That's a myth. That's a clear myth. In fact, people who've had the shot in the past may actually have some residual protection. It's quite to the contrary.
Right. And this whole thing, this whole ball of wax comes undone if, in fact, the vaccine that is available isn't the appropriate vaccine for the kind of flu outbreak that we have. I mean, isn't that a problem as well?
It's an issue, but if you don't demand perfection, you won't be disappointed. No matter how disparate the vaccine and the circulating strain are, there's usually some protection. There was that sort of difference last year, but there was partial protection. And for people who are at high risk of the complications, partial protection is better than none at all.
Mm. Dr. William Schaffner is chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you, and stay healthy, Robin.
Well, I was going to say, any advice for the senators and congressmen in Washington who are, as we hear, getting their flu shots?
If you're shaking a lot of hands, you ought to wash your hands frequently.
I somehow thought you'd say that. Doctor, thank you.
Bye-bye.
And when we come back, flu, common colds, allergies, and the workplace. With fewer vaccines, more employees might join the ranks of the working sick. A problem called presenteeism. It could become a bigger problem than absenteeism. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about the flu, and there is, of course, an economic impact when flu season marches through the American workplace and employees take sick days. But according to an emerging body of research, workers who come in not feeling well are a problem as well. As an allergy sufferer, I know the feeling. In an article in the October issue of the Harvard Business Review, senior editor Paul Hemp looks at the flip side of absenteeism. It's called presenteeism. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
How did you hear about this, presenteeism?
Actually, a fellow who sits next to me in church choir works in the field and mentioned it to me, and the term itself seemed somewhat amusing and to have an interesting twist, and I said, what's that?
And you went to find out and found out what a lot of us know. People come to work sick. Give me a sense of how broad this is.
Well, I think what's interesting about the concept is that they come to work a little bit sick and really well enough to come to work, but you take all those little bits and add them up across a workforce, and you have people not getting as much work done because they feel crummy.
Yeah.
And so you spread the impact of that across an economy or a company, And you have what looks like is a really big loss in productivity, despite the relatively minor nature of these illnesses.
Right. You have many charts and graphs in your article to illustrate that. But can you give us a sense of, for instance, some of the illnesses that people will go to work with and how you then translate that into productivity loss?
Well, that's the challenge. This is an emerging area of research in medical schools and elsewhere to try to figure out what that loss in productivity is and then whether there are cost-effective ways to recover some of that loss.
Well, for instance, you cite a Lockheed Martin study that was commissioned in 2002, and it was done with Tufts New England Medical Center researchers in Boston. And I'll just throw out some from the chart that you have here. If it's a migraine headache, maybe 12% of the time people will have it. I think I'm reading that correctly, the prevalence?
12% of the workforce at a given time period.
Will have it. The average productivity loss, 4.9%. Interesting. There's another one I'll just throw out, the American Productivity Audit. What's that, by the way?
It was a large-scale survey of, I think, a couple hundred thousand workers done by a fellow who was then at Johns Hopkins that asked people how their work was affected by, for example, depression, back pain, allergies. And, you know, there's the dollar amounts that are attached to these are quite large. There's, by some estimates, that across the economy, it costs employers like $150 billion a year in lost productivity.
You talk about Lockheed Martin, for instance, introducing education programs for arthritis sufferers, lunch and learn sessions hosted by a gastroenterologist, so that once the company figured out what the workers were suffering from, they started addressing that.
Right, and relatively inexpensive ways in those cases. What gets more controversial is when a company says, I'll take away the copay on for certain drugs. Actually, Pitney Bowes, the old postal meter company, increased its benefits on certain drugs for arthritis, for example, found that their claims dropped as a result of that. So their investment turned out to return manyfold for them.
I'm astonished. You know, again, as an allergy sufferer, I'm looking at a couple of these charts and graphs. Bank One had their call center workers track their allergies, and it shows the direct effect between, you know, their productivity and the pollen count. When the pollen count went up, their productivity just drops.
That was one of those great situations where you actually could measure productivity. In a knowledge economy, it's pretty hard to measure output of widgets.
Right.
But there was an example where there were very objective measures of the number of calls taken. And sure enough, during spring and fall, people who reported allergy problems were markedly less productive than their counterparts.
And another study of the same kind was done at International Truck and Engine. Same thing. It just falls off the charts when their allergies are up.
Right. Allergies being particularly interesting because, you know, everybody's got them. They don't seem that big a deal except to those who suffer from them.
Yeah. Why do people do it? What's the number one reason that people will come into work even though they're sick?
I should emphasize that from an employer's point of view, forget the employee just for the moment, it's better if they come into work and get a little bit done rather than stay home and just sit and watch soaps all day long.
Can you point out to us some other ways that presenteeism might affect the productivity at a workplace?
These, again, relatively benign illnesses such as your allergies do lead to greater number of workers' comp claims, actually greater number of hospital visits. But what was interesting to me was not those things that are recorded by companies, typically through claims, but that are invisible to companies.
So clarify for me what you're saying, because it sounds as if you're saying that one of the solutions is to adjust copays, to teach your workers about their illnesses. But you haven't mentioned telling people to stay home. Is that a part of it?
Well, it's not. In the context of the flu shot problem, which the flu shot is really the poster child for effective interventions a company can do to reduce the problem of presenteeism. You've subsidized employee flu shots. It's definitely worth your money. That is one area where they're very certain. So I was thinking about that. Now here we don't have flu shots anymore. What are we going to do? Your best tool in this area is gone. So do you tell people to, you know, emphasize prevention? What can you do to keep yourself from getting the flu? One thought that I think is kind of interesting is maybe you accommodate your employees in ways that they could work from home if they had the flu. Yes, they wouldn't work at full speed, but you wouldn't assume that people, just because they were home, they weren't working. And you might make it easier for employees, and they might appreciate that.
Well, geez, and how about just a full-fledged sick day?
Well, I know that's where you're leading me.
Stay home and not work at all.
What I think if they... the idea is what if they're there, how do you make sure that they're doing a better job? Because most people are there when they're right. sick. You're here today.
Right, so if you're there, make sure they have the right allergy medication.
Right.
And if they are genuinely sick, you don't want them, you know, maybe at 60% one day, but by the end of the week at 10 and half dead. So then go home.
10 and half dead and also having infected their right. cubicle mates, too.
Right,
so.
Right. Well, it's fascinating to look at the charts and graphs of what we're all feeling in our foreheads. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Paul Hemp, senior editor at the Harvard Business Review. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Global Security. We'll speak with the man charged with coordinating the counterterrorism efforts of 25 countries. How is the fight against Al-Qaeda going from Europe's point of view? Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Last week, gun-toting undercover agents marched into the headquarters of one of the world's biggest insurance groups, AIG, and arrested two senior executives. That team was acting on orders from New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. On the same day, Spitzer accused Marsh and McLennan of price rigging and kickbacks, and he says he's only just begun. Gretchen Morgenson is a Wall Street columnist for the New York Times. She joins us from New York. Gretchen, first of all, any relationship between Marsh and McLennan and AIG?
Well, there is a family relationship. Hank Greenberg, the chairman of AIG and a titan in the industry, is the father of Jeff Greenberg, the chairman of Marsh and McLennan. And as a matter of fact, Hank has another son that runs a big insurance company called Ace Limited, which is based in Bermuda. So you have a troika of Greenbergs running insurance companies and or brokers, and that makes this scandal very interesting on this kind of a familial basis.
But we should quickly point out, it seems to be spreading from the family businesses to others.
Absolutely. What Elliot Spitzer found is that Marsh seemed to be having other companies help it put out phony bids for insurance that it would broker to companies buying insurance. For example, let's say you need insurance, you're a company, maybe the New York Times company needs insurance. You would go to your broker, and the broker holds himself out as independent and will go around looking for the best coverage at the best price. Well, what Marsh was doing, according to Mr. Spitzer, was enlisting the aid of other companies to put in phony bids so that the person, the insurance company that Marsh had initially wanted to steer the business to, got the business. So it's bid rigging in its ugliest form, and nobody really knew that was going on.
You quote some anonymous brokers who say, yeah, this is what happened.
Yes, and apparently it was a shocker to a lot of people, however. It does have the impact, Robin, of increasing consumers' costs of insurance, and that is what the real nub of this entire investigation is. As we all know, insurance premiums have just skyrocketed, particularly for health care, but in also other areas. And if it is to some degree related to these kinds of practices, then really it's very damaging for the entire industry.
And is this affecting all kinds of insurance?
Well, it looks to be expanding by the day. Mr. Spitzer brought his suit on Thursday of last week against Marsh. He got two guilty pleas from AIG and a guilty plea from an executive at ACE. Now he wants to expand it into health care, home, car, any kind of insurance. He believes there's misconduct in, across the board.
Well, and as you're saying, it affects consumers and the cost of insurance, but it sounds like it's also costly to the employees of the thousands of employees of the companies.
It's really, really sad what's gone on at Marsh. Ever since the suit was brought last Thursday, the stock has lost 50% of its value. And I did a little analysis, and there are just tons of employees who own Marsh stock and who own a lot of it in their retirement accounts. And this is just a devastation that, you know, they're innocent parties. They really probably had nothing to do with it, had no idea what was going on, and yet their retirements are now in half.
Well, Gretchen, as you said, this is devastating for employees. It raises the cost of insurance for all of us. It's been devastating for the industry, stockholders. My question is, why would brokers participate? I mean, why would you put in a phony bid to help somebody else get a bid?
Because the insurance companies doing the phony bidding were promised of getting a business the next time around. It was sort of like a daisy chain type of a scenario. You help me out this time, I'll help you out the next time.
How far do you think this is going to go?
I think this has the potential to be very far-reaching, and we're only really not even in the first week, and it's already taken $10 billion in market value off of one company. I think it has the potential to be very damaging.
Gretchen Morgenson, Wall Street columnist for The New York Times. Gretchen, thank you.
Sure.
I will do what I have said I will do. We will keep the promise of Social Security for our seniors, and there will be no draft as long as I'm the president.
I will wage a smarter, more effective, tougher, broader-based, more inclusive, better war on terror that makes America safer than George Bush has made us.
John Kerry and President Bush on the campaign trail. As the race for the presidency nears its conclusion, 19 states are too close to call. One of them, New Hampshire, could be key this year. The Granite State has just 4 electoral votes, but those votes made all the difference in the last election. In the studios here now is Fred Tice, who spent the last few days reporting in New Hampshire. And Fred, what's at stake there, and why is it, if it is, any different from the other battleground states?
It's no different from the other battleground states, but it is one of those states where the election is so close that this one state could make all the difference. 4 years ago, Al Gore stopped campaigning in New Hampshire. He focused on other parts of the country, and it cost him the presidency. Last Friday, I spoke to Jennifer Donahue, political advisor to the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College in Manchester, about this.
Bush won it by one percentage point in 2000. Had Gore won New Hampshire, Gore would have been president.
Many of those who were Gore supporters are having that same sinking feeling in their stomach that they had 4 years ago. But where do things stand now in New Hampshire?
Things are really just as close. The latest poll was conducted Friday, Saturday, Sunday over the weekend and after the last presidential debate. And it showed that Kerry now has 46%, Bush 41%, Nader 1%, and 12% are undecided. The Kerry-Bush difference is within the margin of error. I spoke to Dante Scala, an associate professor of political science at St. Anselm College, about this.
Bush is lagging here in New Hampshire a point or two behind his standing in the national polls. And so I think if that pattern holds, George Bush is going to have to do pretty well nationally, I'd say 50, 51% in order to carry New Hampshire. I think right now, as things stand, if it's a very close race nationally, I think John Kerry will carry New Hampshire.
And now that is going to come as a surprise, that kind of thinking, to people who follow New Hampshire politics. Used to be, there was a very conservative newspaper there that had a stronghold on a lot of the voters. What's happening now in New Hampshire about this election? Are people excited about it? Are they talking about it?
They're very excited about it. There's an unbelievable number of registrations. Yesterday I was just in Rye, New Hampshire, a small town on the seacoast, very prosperous, full of transplants who've got good jobs in Massachusetts, who've come across the border to live in in New Hampshire. And the clerk there was saying she's getting something like 10 to 15 people a day in this small town registering. That's a lot for them. She's talked to town clerks all over the state. They're finding the same kind of thing. And what's happening is these people are moving into New Hampshire, many, many of them from Massachusetts. Most of them are moving to southern New Hampshire. And that's tilting the balance. You know, this bedrock Republican state is becoming a 50-50 state.
And when we've been up there reporting, we heard from longtime residents that they were upset about manufacturing jobs leaving the state. So any sense of how the registrations are going, which party?
Yeah, there is a good sense, and it's kind of ominous for the Republicans. Most people are registering as independents, the overwhelming majority, but Republicans are really lagging this time.
And finally, last time, Ralph Nader, big factor in New Hampshire. How about this time?
Well, polls show that this time Ralph Nader could influence the outcome in 9 states by drawing support from Kerry, and it looks like one of those states is New Hampshire once again.
Okay, tension on both sides. Fred Tice, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
WBUR's Here and Now's Fred Tice. Still to come, following the Falcon Amelia to the edge of the earth. You're listening to Here and Now. Bike riders can travel from Canada to Florida, but bike paths are sporadic. Cyclists envision an East Coast greenway that would allow them to ride the entire route along bike paths, sort of an Interstate 95 for cyclists. Here now's Karen Given has the story of one group's attempt to ride to Florida and raise awareness along the way.
Boston to Worcester. Theme of the day is Boston exurbs.
Tour leader Max Sexton gathers his riders in the lobby of the Boston hostel and flips through the dozen maps that make up today's ride. The day begins with 12 miles along the well-marked and maintained Charles River bike path. But before long, the group will have to navigate the long stretches of road that link the Greenway's trails.
And then I'm not sure. Haven't been through there.
The East Coast Greenway is currently only 20% complete, which means that for more than 2,000 of the 2,600 miles between the Canadian border and the tip of Florida, the group will be sharing the road with cars. By 2010, the Alliance hopes that 80% of the Greenway will be off-road, mostly along abandoned railroad lines. But if you're not up for a 2,600-mile bike ride, don't worry. Over breakfast, Myron Scott, a 55-year-old rider from Alpharetta, Georgia, says one doesn't have to ride from end to end to benefit from the Greenway.
What the Greenway can do for this country is what we need so badly. The Greenway can let you meet your neighbors, because it's not just for going from Maine to Key West. It's for walking your dog and walking your baby in your neighborhood away from the road.
The riders have raised $10,000 apiece for the East Coast Greenway, but that won't put much of a dent in the $1.5 billion needed to build 2,600 miles of trail. Most of that money will have to be raised through local fundraising and federal grants. And some local communities face strong opposition from people who worry trails will bring crime and noise to their backyards. But before any of these issues can be worked out, local communities first have to know the effort to build an East Coast Greenway exists. That's where Myron comes in.
I stopped the other day in New Hampshire. A couple was walking their two children in a baby carriage, kind of on the edge of the road. And I stopped and talked with them. They'd never heard of the East Coast Greenway. I told them about it. They were very supportive. I said, look, why don't you go to your town council meeting when they're considering the Greenway and let your feelings be known.
New Jersey bike activists Mike and Ann Krumer have been letting their feelings be known for more than 15 years. Safety is of primary importance to the Krumers. In August of 1992, Ann and Mike were enjoying a beautiful summer afternoon running errands on their bikes.
Lady was in a hurry to get to the supermarket, and she pulled in front of me, and I only about a foot away. I went, hit her right front fender and went over her hood.
And after the accident, I literally went into the intensive care unit, and she was in recovery. from surgery, and I literally went in there and looked her right in the face and says, "You got to put back in your head that we're going to bicycle and we're going to go travel." 11 months later, she hopped on the front of that bicycle and we started cycling again.
Anne is paralyzed from the waist down. She rides in the front of the Kroomer's tandem recumbent bike and contributes to the couple's locomotion and her own fitness by use of a hand crank. She says it took a lot of trust in her husband to get back on the road. But Mike says getting off the road is the ultimate goal.
We've been working for 15 years to get a trail built that would parallel that road that we were on. We would have been on that trail instead of the road, so she would not be in a chair if that trail had been there. And hopefully, we got our fingers crossed that next year they're going to put pavement down and open that trail. And that trail will become part of the East Coast Greenway.
Breakfast complete, maps in hand, and bags stowed in the support vehicle, the group takes on the first task of the day, navigating a few blocks of city traffic to reach the Charles River bike path. After that, there's the traffic and confusing roads of Boston suburbs, the challenging hills of central Massachusetts, and countless strangers to meet and educate along the way. The inaugural riders of the East Coast Greenway will be on the trails and alongside roads until they can dip their toes in the sand of Higgs Beach in Key West, Florida, on November 3rd.
Our story from Karen Given. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Alan Tennant is a nature lover and field guide. While on a sailing trip, he told filmmaker Terrence Malick about the time he tracked a peregrine falcon from Texas to Alaska. Malick said, "That's a book and a movie." Well, the movie's in the works. Alan's book is called On the Wing to the Edge of the Earth with the Peregrine Falcon. It tells of how he attached some old transmitters to several wild falcons, enlisted George Vose, a 70-something pilot with a beat-up old Cessna, and set off, illegally crossing borders, often crash-landing, to follow the falcons. And Alan joins us in the studio. Hello.
Oh, boy, this is great.
Well, you know, I love this book. It's as if Hopalong Cassidy and Jack Kerouac decided to join the Audubon Society.
Well, we just became obsessed, I guess. We became completely caught up with this incredible, incredible creature that we could follow. Now, falconry for over 1,000 years was the Super Bowl, the World Series, the NBA playoffs of royal sport. What fascinated us, though, was that these creatures, when they take off to migrate, they go all the way across the hemispheres. Every day we were behind Amelia, which was the first one we followed north. We never knew where we would land that evening. We knew basically that she probably was going to the Arctic. Whether that meant Greenland or Alaska, we didn't know.
And how do they do that? How does she know to hang a right at the Rockies, to hang a left? How do they know?
Well, you know, there's lots of theory about that. And some birds, smaller birds, may migrate sort of instinctually by stars or by moon. But I think, having followed several peregrines now across the continents, at least the adults just know where they're going. It's like going across the country and stopping at familiar motels. Mm. And the young ones going south had no idea where they were going. We flew 10,000 miles between the Rio Grande and the Guatemalan border because they went back and forth, and the babies are just wandering. One of them went back to Texas, and I think they just learn the way.
Mm. You mentioned the ones that you followed south, Gorda and Delgada, and the little fellow. There was one that you met as a tiny chick up in Alaska, and you didn't think he was going to survive. You banded him up there, and then you meet him later?
Right.
What are the chances of that?
Oh, infinitesimally small. Infinitesimally small.
It's an adventure. I held my breath wondering if Amelia was going to make it, if your plane was going to make it.
Well, we were holding our breath a lot, too.
You land in the middle of wars, drug heists,
and a Mexican military base.
Right. The outfit that you're wearing now has several patches on. Is this the phony outfit that you wore?
This is the phony outfit. I went to a Texas Highway Patrol supply store and bought this uniform. I had patches put on the shoulders, one of which says Falcon Tracking Team. Well, little did I know, but the popular term for the secret police is Falcons, and so the little street urchins that came up, you know, to sell us gum would run when they saw Falcone patches.
And all of this, Alan, for a bird with a 7-ounce wing. Again, why?
Well, Amelia, we thought we might follow her for a day or two. People had told us that she would go up through the high passes in the Rockies and then we'd lose her, but she didn't. She went along the Front Range and we'd buoyed up over her, behind her, on the same air currents and then dropped when she dropped and felt what she felt and saw what she saw. And that was the most, to be with a wild creature living its life, totally unaware that you're part of its world, not intruding on it, not trapping it, not anything that it can even see or be aware of, but yet living its life day after day, week after week, was just the most astonishing thing I'd ever done.
Yeah. To see a falcon dive for prey has got to be an extraordinary thing.
Well, now that's the thing falconers have been obsessed with for thousands of years, watching falcons rip down out of the sky.
What do they do again? But, describe it.
Well, they fold up into sort of like a fist, and it's a bullet-shaped fist. And they drop maybe up to 200 miles an hour. But even more magnetic than that, and many other birds do this too, but we had the transmitter on a falcon, is they go from continent to continent, and you can follow them in the little plane. We were able to all this way. Now, we knew that satellite tracking was coming, but we wanted to go before that happened, when we could actually go with the bird, be with her, and live her life. It's this imperative to be into the sky that's almost inconceivable to humans.
Mm. You're not a scientist.
This is a book that's sort of almost a love story of what we were drawn toward, what I was drawn toward and kind of drug my pilot into, and the loss of a relationship that it cost me and family ties and everything else.
Right. But it did seem as if along the way you did discover some things that are harming the peregrine falcon.
Well, we saw along the way the environmental degradation that's harming not only falcons, who are sort of an environmental monitor, but are harming all the rest of us as well. There's sort of a Rachel Carson element to this that you couldn't avoid. When we get down into Latin America, the young falcons, a great many of them don't come back after their first winter south of the border, and we found these and saw, anyone could see this, but we came on these enormous sludge ponds that the petrochemical industry pumps their oil residue into. Shorebirds feed on the invertebrates all around those, and then falcons feed on the shorebirds, which have metabolically concentrated the chemicals that they picked up from these oil sludge ponds, and it doesn't take much to do one in,
right,
to do a falcon in.
Right. Well, so it was research, it was adventure, and it was ultimately a love story between you and the birds and you and someone else. Could you read for us, Alan Tennant, part of the closing chapter of the book, some conclusions you drew about the trip that you made?
The real dream I saw had been ours, that by joining our peregrine's ancient journey, we could somehow become part of their essential heroism. The hidden struggle of the million avian lives that all around us were rushing through storm and famine, downpour and sudden predation, always with the homeward streaming determination that, for some of them, would at last overcome the barrier of inconceivable distance. It was what Delgada, lost in the Paraquat forest, and Gorda, now flown away to sea, had given George and me. It was the grail I'd sought long ago on the prairie marshes of my boyhood, a time when I'd had no real home and had longed to join the cranes, join the geese, join every hawk and skittering shorebird whose breast burned with the power of return to the distant harbors I also sought. Yet that awareness had been costly to me and to another caring person, Jen.
Jen. Jen was your girlfriend who tried to put up with your wanderlust. Whatever happened to Jen?
That came to an end. I saw too late that the obsession with the birds was the lesser choice that I should have made, and it was too late by that point to go back.
What does Jen say about the book?
Oh, I've seen her in years, many years.
Really? Wow. She doesn't even know she's a character in your book.
No.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And it seems to me, too, that the birds had another lesson for you because you couldn't really go where they went anyway in the final analysis.
Ultimately, in both ends of the trip, Amelia flew away into the Arctic We couldn't land as we had gotten closer to the poles. It was nothing but tundra. We couldn't get the plane on the ground. And then in Central America, our strongest guiding angel, I guess you'd say, Gorda, flew out to sea. And we had engine trouble, couldn't go on after her, and she flew on across the Caribbean.
Is it a story, though, completely about loss?
Oh, it's about loss and gain and learning and being part of a larger, older world that I'd always known was there from childhood. The cost was high, but we gained a lot as well.
Alan Tennant, his book is called On the Wing, To the Edge of the Earth with the Peregrine Falcon. Alan, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.